Struggling didn't do much good. But just now and then he couldn't avoid feeling the great echoing void of his life, and it hurt unbearably. Cassim was making it hurt. This companionship was so joyous. It reminded Dazel forcibly of how alone he'd been before, and how alone he'd be again. But he had become adept at living in the moment, so he tried to focus on the pleasure of having someone to travel with, sharing meals and making plans. Cassian's quiet conversation, and the smile that lurked in his eyes far more often than it made its way to his mouth. Cassian's warmth constantly near him. Dazel liked physical closeness and affectionate touch. Waking up with his arm over Cassian had been perfect. Nearly perfect. Perfect would have involved him moving his hands down and pulling Cassian round, and finding out what those curved lips could do, how his sun and rain eyes might widen, what that neat, compact body felt like, and how it responded. Unfortunately, Cassian was a conventional gentleman. Unless he liked someone enough, he'd said. And Dazel wasn't sufficiently sure about that. And since he wasn't willing to risk their companionship for a chance at physical gratification, really he was becoming terribly mature, he had better leave well alone. He took a long pull at his ale. What about you then, any luck today? Cassian took a second to register what he was talking about. Yes, no, I visited every inn here, not just coaching inns, and asked questions till the words lost meaning and got nowhere. If he came through here, he didn't stay, and nobody remembers. Of course, that doesn't mean he didn't. Just that we won't know where he's gone, although presumably you can find your search to the town. If he changed at one of the staging posts further out. I thought that too, Cassian said, with the oddly pleased look he often had at such moments, like a schoolboy who had the answer to a question. But I visited all of those within walking distance. I thought we might try the rest tomorrow. Dazel felt a pulse of guilt. We could have done it today if I hadn't been playing the fool with a vicar. Miss Beaumont needed your help, and a person is more important than an object. He said that as though he thought Dazel might argue. The ring matters a great deal to me, but if we'd gone looking for it, even found it, and then heard Sir James had tracked her down when we could have prevented it. No, you did the right thing. It might not slow Sir James down at all. We don't even know he'll come this way. This was the best we could do. We can't do more. We oughtn't do less, but we can't do more. He said we, and he thought Dazel was doing his best. And Dazel felt his ever-hungry heart thump. I still want to find your ring, though. We'll ask at the further flung inns tomorrow, and failing that, we'll make a plan. We'll do that, Cassian said, tapped his glass to Dazel's, and smiled. They were sharing a bed again. It was torture. At least they'd both been exhausted the previous night. This evening, Dazel was wide awake as he surreptitiously watched Cassian moving around the room. Wide awake as he noted the lines of that smooth, near-hairless back and chest. The man shaved once in 2 days, he'd noticed, and that seemed optimistic. Wide awake when Cassian got in the bed next to him, his lighter weight meaning it would be so easy for him to roll towards Dazel, which he did not. He didn't, but Dazel was so very nearly sure he wanted to. The way he looked, the way he blushed, the glances he stole, none of which constituted an invitation to touch, or at least not a conscious one. And the problem with deciding that people were unconsciously inviting was that you could be wrong, and in fact you weren't invited at all. And then there would be outrage, or dismay, or alarm. And none of those were emotions Dazel would care to evoke. Cassian was breathing softly, shallow and even. It sounded as though he'd gone straight to sleep. Dazel had no idea how, unless, of course, Cassian wasn't at all troubled by the nearness of bare legs. The possibility of reaching out, hands meeting, exploring skin. He wondered if he could toss himself off without disturbing his companion's rest. Are you awake? He murmured very quietly. There was a short silence. Yes. It sounded a touch reluctant. Why? Marvelous. Now he'd started a conversation. So am I. Cassian made a noise of mild exasperation. Have you considered sleeping? Good idea. Cassian shifted, turning towards him. Is something wrong? Wrong? No, why? I don't know, you seem... He paused there. I hope I didn't offend you earlier. What, how? Asking questions. I've no right to interrogate you, and I dare say you might not wish to rehearse events which doubtless were very distressing. Daisel deciphered that. The elopement? It wasn't distressing. Somewhat wounding to my pride and very tiresome, that's all. You looked when you spoke of it. Cassian paused again. Not yourself. Cassian thought he was lying awake because he was upset. That was charming in its way, even if wrong. But perhaps not entirely wrong in every aspect, because Daisel found himself saying, Well, it's not much to be proud of. What isn't? Any of it. Eloping with a woman I didn't know. Failing to elope. Being fooled by a schoolgirl, in fact. Sir James, all the rest of it. He paused. My father. He was sure Cassian knew, and the silence confirmed that. After a moment, his bedmate spoke cautiously. I did hear about your father. You could hardly not. George Charnage had capped a career of gambling, extravagance, unpaid debts, and almost continual inebriation by losing a fortune he didn't have at whist. He'd invited the two men he'd played with for another match at his house the next night, offering as stake all he had left, the house and its contents. They came with money in their pockets, ready to reduce George Charnage and his family to beggary for their night's entertainment. Instead, he and Daisel's mother had held them at gunpoint, stripped them of everything down to their clothing, and shot one of them when he resisted. Daisel had come home late the next morning after a night's debauchery in South London to discover an enraged man in his drawers bound and gagged in the drawing room and another lying on the floor in a pool of blood. George and Anna Charnage had left Mr. Henry Haddon untended, unconscious, and bleeding all night. When Daisel had knelt to help him, the bone had been visible in his shattered shoulder. He died a few hours later. Apart from a furious man and a dying one, the house had been bare. Daisel's mother and father had packed up everything they owned of value, plus the proceeds of that candlelight robbery, and fled the country. They hadn't told their son of their plans beforehand, and they hadn't invited his company in their escape or exile. They had left him as the only one of the family there to blame. And he had been blamed. His father was cousin to the Marquis of Sellingstow, who had given him an allowance on the basis of family obligation. At the scandal, Sellingstow had publicly repudiated the connection, cutting off Daisel too. His name was bloodstained and disgraced. George Charnage's other victim had claimed the house in lieu of the debt. Daisel found himself with nowhere to live, no income, no skills, and no connections who would give him work. If there was any work he might be fit for, given his curtailed education and lack of adult occupation. He had been left with nothing but a tenuous claim to be a gentleman, a decent wardrobe, a likable manner, and a knack for cutting profiles. He'd survived for 7 years on those things and the tolerance of hosts which, like the wardrobe, became more threadbare every year. He was unwanted, aimless and useless. And though he'd always thought he'd somehow find a way out of the mess, it had never come to pass. He swallowed all that down. But it can't be helped, he did what he did. I would prefer it if people didn't blame me for his acts, that's all. Do they? Cassian said. How? That is, you were not involved, were you? Daisel hated the question in his voice. He'd been asked too often. No, I wasn't. Cassian didn't reply. Daisel blinked into the dark, reminding himself that he was a provincial gentleman, that he wasn't to know and had every right to ask. that it was all a long time ago and a life away. I was in Vauxhall Gardens all that night, he said slightly less harshly. A friend had a small party. I had no idea what my parents had planned. They didn't tell me Father had lost everything at whist the night before. They certainly didn't advise me they'd be enlivening the evening with robbery and murder. I came home to an empty house and a dying man. They didn't even leave a note. They just did it and fled. But they said nothing, not even goodbye. Have you not heard from them since? No. He had never received a letter. Perhaps his parents had written to the house he no longer lived in, or care of friends or relatives Daisel no longer saw. Or perhaps they hadn't written at all. He'd given up wondering a while ago, because wondering meant hoping, and he couldn't do that anymore. Cassian was eloquently silent. Daisel sighed. I told you about my name. Well, my father was always like that. He was loud and he drank, and I'm not sure he fully understood that other people were real too. He was convinced that anyone who behaved in a way he found inconvenient must be doing it out of personal malice towards him. We were all minor actors in the play of which he was the star. Even your mother. Oh, she agreed with him, Daisel said. I expect it was the only way to live with him, but he was the heart of her world. She worshipped him, whatever he did. She loved me too, but only in the space he left for that, and he didn't leave much. A jealous god, my father, and didn't like to share. When he said, take a gun and help me commit a robbery, she would have done it without hesitation. I expect she wept over leaving me behind, but that didn't stop her going, or leaving me to take the blame for their mess. But why should you take it? Cassian demanded. How could you be blamed when you weren't there? Someone had to be. Vere very much wanted a scapegoat. Vere, Sir James? He was the other man in the house. He and his friend Haddon came ready to play deep. Apparently they intended to strip my father of everything he had left, down to his home and, according to some rumours, my mother's person. Instead, Vere lost £2,000 that night, as well as his friend, so one can quite understand he wanted vengeance. And since I was the only charnage available, he took it out on me. What did he do? Daisel shut his eyes, feeling the backwash of bewilderment, distress, injustice, helplessness. It seems my mother wore breeches and a kerchief over her face while holding the gun. Vere claimed to believe it was me. He told everyone I was my father's accomplice. But you were in Vauxhall. I know. I had witnesses. But I never had a day in court to say so, since he never tried to press charges. Instead, he made a lot of remarks about how he couldn't see the face of the second robber, about the hair, my mother's was like mine, about drunken evenings and lying friends protecting me, and how he can't prove it, but he knows. All implications. But he's been whispering them so long. And what was I meant to do? Slam my hand on the table and say, no, sir, I did not conspire at robbery and murder. That was my mother. I'd lost everything. The house, the money, my parents. And Vere was spinning lies and sowing doubt. And people looked at me differently, and I didn't know what to do. I just didn't know what to do. He felt his voice fade in the darkness. One of the men I was with in Vauxhall went to the wars and died there. And another I barely knew and wasn't much in society himself. There was nobody speaking for me, whereas Vere was always there. And I suppose many people found it easier to believe that I had held up a man with a pistol than that my mother had. Well, they didn't really believe it, but enjoyed the gossip. Or perhaps nobody wanted my company anyway, with my father a murderer. In any case, people turned their backs. I'm so sorry, Daisel. Cassian's voice ached. That is dreadful. I quite see why you loathe Vere. Oh, that part only made me dislike him, Daisel said. The loathing came. He glared at the night. Cassian was so close and 100 miles away. I suppose you ought to know if you're in my company and all that. It wasn't, shouldn't have been, dreadful, but the thing is, I stay with people, you see, as one does when one is a gentleman lacking any means of support. A few weeks here or there. One has to be an entertaining guest, if possible, so I cut shades. My one talent. I sing for my supper with profiles as an entertaining little trick for a gentleman, which is quite different from being a jobbing artist. But some house parties are less reputable than others, and people have different ideas of entertainment, and to cut, as it were, a long story short, I have done some rather risque scenes for people who wanted them. Oh. Cassian sounded startled. Daisel would bet he was blushing, could picture how his cheeks had pinked. I didn't realize. That is, can you, with profiles? Lord, yes, full-length ones, you know, and scenes. You'd be amazed. I probably would, I had no idea. He sounded intrigued. Daisel hadn't taken up his scissors in days. It had been a relief not to. But he had a sudden urge to snip something that would make Cassian really blush. Even more, to ask him what he'd like to see, and to watch his face as the figures emerged from the paper. Stop it! It was a gentleman's entertainment, he said. Something for groups of men without ladies present, or with ladies who weren't being ladylike. Entirely private. But then, a couple of months later, I was staying with some rather straight-laced distant cousins, who felt an obligation to me despite my father's behaviour, and they held a soiree and invited their neighbours, who included Miss Beaumont and Sir James Vere. They knew of Sir James's grudge against my father, of course, but they believed that I wasn't involved, and said they wanted amity restored. And Vere smiled at me in the most unpleasant way. And an hour or so into proceedings, he took me aside and informed me he had obtained some of my more disreputable shades. He had shown them to my cousins and told them I was secretly making obscene postures for the young people at the party, corrupting them. What? Why? Why did he do it? Revenge. Why, he told me. Possibly because he wanted to see my face. But also so I couldn't look surprised or innocent when my cousins confronted me about it. It was a well-laid trap. I denied cutting anything unfit at their house, but they had the profiles as evidence, and there we are. That was why I agreed to elope with Miss Beaumont. Vere had cut me off from the last members of my family who'd speak to me out of sheer spite. And I was drifting around the place, wondering what on earth I'd do. Great God, Daisel, I'm so sorry. Cassian's hand groped for his, sliding under the sheets, fingers warm and close and comforting. This is appalling. I had no idea. Vere is a vile, hateful man, and I'm disgusted, though not surprised. But your father? How could he do that to you? He ruined you as much as his other victims, and people blame you for it. Everyone had blamed him, if only by contagion. He'd been cut so often it had felt like real cuts. Each turned head or blank look, a blade on his skin. Daisel was a companionable man. He'd thought he had plenty of friends, just as he'd believed in his father's careless affection and his mother's love. But when it came down to the bone, people didn't help and they didn't stay. They looked to their own well-being and left you behind. He hadn't helped himself, of course. He'd been tainted by his parents' crime, but he'd blackened his own reputation as thoroughly as he had ever blackened paper for a profile, in a slow, steady slide out of the polite world and into disreputability that he couldn't seem to stop. It's my own fault, he said aloud. Well, and my parents, of course. But I haven't helped myself. I was expelled from Eton, you know. I did hear a gambling ring. Quite a lively one, Daisel admitted. There had been a few running at Eton. His syndicate had, unfortunately, taken rather too much of various young noblemen's allowances, and an example had been made. Like father, like son. I made plenty more mistakes, too. I was a careless fool before the robbery, and after I was a drunken one for a while. And perhaps if I had stood up for myself better, people wouldn't have found it so easy to tar me with the same brush. But none of that is a crime. Cassian sounded really angry now. The profiles were definitely dubious. It's hardly surprising people don't think much of me. Cassian's hand tightened. Well, they're wrong, and I do. Why? The word tore itself from a throat that was already hurting with control. Cassian took a moment to answer. With another man, Dazel would have pulled his hand away at that pause. But he was getting used to the little silences as Cassian thought about what he was going to say. "Because you're kind," he said at last. "I quite believe you would make impulsive decisions, or unconventional ones, or bad ones. But you go out of your way to help people. You risked your neck in a coach crash to protect someone else's baby. I would never believe you were involved in a robbery or corrupting youth or anything like that. And if anyone does, they're a fool." He squeezed Dazel's fingers hard and relapsed into silence. Dazel lay, eyes stinging in the dark, not entirely knowing what he felt except that it hurt. But also that it hurt in a good way, like the picking off of a tight, ugly scab. It didn't really matter if Cassian, a gentleman of wealth but no account, thought he was a good person. The world had decided him to be a not-quite-gentleman of bad stock and poor character, and one man's opinion wouldn't change that. But all the same, here in the quiet of the room, it felt like everything. Cassian's fingers were still entwined with his, sufficiently relaxed that he could pull away if he wanted. He didn't, and the touch was a comfort in the dark. This time, Dazel woke up with his arm over Cassian and his face buried in the man's shoulder. Cassian was breathing evenly under him. Dazel allowed himself a moment to enjoy the physical contact, then peeled himself off and rolled onto his back. Tried to do it without shaking the bed or waking his bedmate, but Cassian grunted. "Morning," Dazel said with determined cheer. "No more soul-searching. They had a job to do. Are we going round the outskirts today?" "Chasing a man in a mulberry coat, oh." Dazel rubbed his face. "You know, if he changes his coat..." "That has occurred to me too. Am I wasting our time, Daze? I don't have anything better to do with mine. And I've got a month off, so..." He couldn't help asking, "A month off what?" Cassian stilled. It was a tiny quiver of tension, which Dazel wouldn't have noticed if they hadn't been so close. "Oh, normal life and duties and whatnot, I'm not expected back for a month," is what I meant. "So, like you, I've nothing better to do." He paused. "I suppose..." "What?" "I was wondering if it would be a dreadful dereliction to look at Stratford while we're here. There's the church, and I believe Shakespeare's birthplace is preserved." He sounded longing. "You should absolutely see them while you're here," Dazel said. "If you want, I can go around the staging posts on the outskirts while you visit the sites." "No," Cassian said reluctantly. "That would be very tedious for you and not very fair." Dazel knew an impulse to suggest they both forget the whole thing, since his faith in their chances, never high, was more or less exhausted. He bit it back and thought about what a useful and efficient person might say. "Perhaps we could try to track your quarry down today. If we get a good lead, we'll follow it, and if we don't, we take tomorrow as a holiday and decide what to do next." "That's a good idea," Cassian said, perking up. "Yes. I don't want to feel consumed by guilt at not looking, but this travelling business is rather tiring." "Do you spend a lot of time consumed by guilt?"
"A certain amount. I was brought up to take my responsibilities very seriously."
"I wasn't."
"Perhaps we could," he waggled a hand, "strike an average."
"That's an excellent idea," Cassian said, a laugh in his voice. "So we will be exceedingly responsible today and take a holiday tomorrow." They did precisely that. It made for a blasted long day. Cassian hired a couple of hacks and they rode out along the crossroads from Stratford to the first stage on each, asking at inns, talking to coach drivers, searching for the man in the mulberry coat. They had, to Dazel's entire lack of surprise, no luck at all. Nobody had seen their quarry or remembered him if they had. It was a great deal of riding for nothing. If you counted quiet, easy conversation and companionable silences as nothing. They were everything. Dazel needed people, needed friendship and talk and laughter and touch. Solitude drained his soul, leaving him bleak and joyless. Companionship had him fizzing with energy. He tried to restrain that, since Cassian was clearly the opposite, and made sure not to babble when his companion lapsed into one of his many thoughtful silences, not wanting his own presence to grate. He didn't need to be always talking anyway. He was quite happy looking around, watching the world go by, as long as he had someone to do it with. Not just someone. Cassian, with his gentle voice, murmuring enchantments to his blasted lucky horse. Daisel could listen to that all day. He also rode superbly and made some fairly cogent criticisms of Daisel's seat, which indicated more clearly than anything yet that he was an exceptional horseman. A horseman with things to do he didn't care to discuss, and knowledge that Daisel wasn't sure how he came by. "How did you know about the gambling ring?" he asked as they rode back. "At school, that I was sacked for that."
"Actually, I was at Eton myself, a few years below you. So, you know, I heard it mentioned."
He looked a bit pink.
"I'm sorry, I know it's not pleasant to be gossiped about. I had it coming. You were at Eton, is that how you knew me?"
Daisel couldn't remember if Cassian had mentioned it on their first meeting. He hadn't paid much attention.
"I was, didn't I say? But it hardly matters, you wouldn't have noticed me."
Probably not. Daisel's friends at school had been as loud and boisterous as himself, and he hadn't troubled to acquaint himself with younger pupils. He might have thought the name would ring a bell, though, unusual as it was. Vernon Cassian. No, he could not for the life of him remember any such boy. He did, now he thought about it, have a vague memory of some undersized shrimp with a pale face whom he was meant to have noted for some reason or other. It tugged at his mind a moment, then he lost the thread. But as Cassian said, it hardly mattered. If he didn't want to tell Daisel things, he probably had good reason. And Daisel didn't intend to spoil the companionship they had with pushing where he wasn't invited. A long day on horseback, a pleasant, tired evening afterwards. The White Swan was a comfortable inn, rather better than the kind of place Daisel normally stayed. He enjoyed feeling like a man of means, even if they weren't his means. And Cassian had lost his initial air of a visitor at the Zoological Gardens and seemed very comfortable. "Should we talk about what to do next?" Daisel said as they addressed an excellent veal and ham pie.
"I know we're declaring a holiday tomorrow if you still want to do that."
"I do." "Afterwards." He made a face at his plate.
"Do you think we've any hope?"
"Really?"
"Of finding John Martin?"
"Honestly? No."
"Oh."
"If he was more distinctive in appearance, or if we had been sooner on his track, we might have stood a chance, or not lost so much time to the crash and then Miss Beaumont."
"Those couldn't be helped."
"Not much of it can be," Daisel said. "Including being robbed in the first place." Cassian gave an unhappy little laugh.
"On the contrary, that's the only part I could have controlled.
In retrospect, yes, just as I could have discovered that my parents were planning to commit a violent crime and abandon me. If either of us could see the future, we'd be a deal better off. As it is, sometimes things just don't go our way. Are you going to treat everyone as a possible thief now? I'm not going to treat everyone as if they're keeping some cursed great secret from me." Cassian's mouth dropped open. He looked like Daisel had slapped him for a second, the color rushing to his face. Then he said,
"Well, yes, no, that is, I see what you mean, but one can't disavow responsibility. It was my duty to keep the ring safe, and I lost it."
"You can take responsibility for that, you have. What you can't do is magic the thing back onto your finger by sufficient application of guilt."
"If I could, I'd have retrieved it days ago."
"I believe that. Look, I don't think we'll find the man, but there's a decent chance he pawned or sold the ring straight away, as we said at the start. And it's the ring you want, yes? So we take tomorrow to recover our energies, and then we retrace our steps to where we know he was.
and try the pawn shops, and find out how one gets in touch with sellers of stolen property. We'll keep looking as long as you like. No stone unturned.
Yes, Cassian said. Yes, that's a plan.
Thank you, Daze. I don't know what I'd do without you.
Dazel did his best not to glow. He very much liked the feeling of being useful, and knew a powerful desire to earn it by finding this blasted ring.
I'm sure you'd manage, but I'm glad I can help.
They smiled at each other across the food, warmth lighting Cassian's sun and rain eyes, and another bit of Dazel's full heart slipped out of his control. Tonight was going to be agony. Chapter 8. This time he woke up with Cassian not just in his arms, but between his legs. Dazel had to take a moment. Cassian's nightshirt had ridden up, and Dazel was wrapped around him, arm over his chest, face in his shoulder, thigh over his hip, and Prick, with a serious case of morning wood, pressed against his bare ass. At least the thin cloth of Dazel's nightgown was between them. He'd fucked people less intimately than this. They hadn't, had they? He rapidly checked his memory, but no, they had not drunk to excess. They had gone to bed in a perfectly decorous manner, and apparently they'd woken up spooning like lovers. Or at least, Dazel was spooning, and Dazel had woken. Cassian was breathing lightly. If he was still asleep, Dazel might be able to peel himself off without the man feeling like he'd been violated in the night. Dazel didn't know what the devil he was doing in his sleep these days. He knew himself to be tiresomely mobile and very prone to outflung arms, because he'd had plenty of complaints. But he'd never woken up in this sort of tangle with a bedmate of convenience, as evidenced by the fact that he still had all his teeth. He needed to do something about this. Unfortunately, he had a very good idea why his sleeping body wanted to wrap itself around Cassian, and a lowering suspicion that he'd need the cooperation of a waking body to mend matters. This was not the time to consider that. He needed to extricate himself without disturbing Cassian, and he needed to do it Prick first, because nobody wanted to wake up to someone else's unsolicited erection. If he could somehow inch his hips back and away, this wouldn't be quite so disastrous. He took a second to listen to Cassian's breathing so that he could judge his movements. It was soft, shallow and even, just like the other night, when they'd talked. Oh Christ, he was awake. Dazel's stomach plunged. What could he do now? Simply apologize, treat it as a joke? Behave as though he thought Cassian was asleep and they could pretend this hadn't happened? Pretend he'd just woken up himself with a lot of yawning. No, wait. If Cassian was awake, why was he just lying there? Was he panicking? He didn't feel as though he was panicking, and Dazel could feel a lot of him at this moment, much of it bare skin. He couldn't possibly. Dazel called upon every bit of nerve he had. Cass? Silence. Then, quietly. Yes? I seem to be.
I know.
Would you like me to move?
Another silence. Then, almost inaudibly.
No.
Dazel stared at the back of his neck, the curve where it met a slim shoulder. Cassian was warm and delightfully solid, and the word yielding was in his mind now.
To be clear, do you want me not to move, as in don't move away, or not to move, as in don't make any further advances? Not that this was an advance as such, I just woke up like this, but for the sake of clarity and also decency, or at least good behavior, I'm going to stop talking, but which was it?
I think I've forgotten the question, Cassian said.
And there was a tremor in his voice that might have been nerves or laughter or both,
and which was extremely emboldening, much like the very comfortable way Daisel's prick was fitting against his neat, firm ass.
I could stay still, Daisel said, or I could get away from you, or I could neither stay still nor get away.
Don't get away. Cassian's voice was a whisper, a charm. But if you don't want to stay still, I shouldn't want to make you.
He shifted back a touch as he spoke, pressing into Daisel, who took a moment to pray he wasn't dreaming.
Cassian in his arms, rubbing against him, sleepy and perfect.
You do move around a lot.
I'm restive.
Daisel slid his leg along Cassian's thigh, just to see, and almost choked at the light touch of exploring fingers meeting his skin, moving delicately up.
Oh God, Cass, is this?
This is perfect, Cassian murmured. Just like this. Or...
He reached backwards and tugged at Daisel's nightshirt.
Daisel yanked it up, bunching the fabric above his waist, then shifted forward. That put them skin to skin, his prick explosively hard now. Cassian inhaled sharply and breathed out with unmistakable relish. Daisel let his own hand drift downwards, across smooth chest and soft stomach, down to coarse curls. And then his questing fingers found what they sought, and he wrapped his hand around Cassian's stand with a pulse of intense satisfaction.
Cassian whimpered.
Oh, yes. Daze, could you? He shifted a bit up the bed so that Daisel's stand was at the juncture of his thighs.
That seemed an excellent idea.
Daisel nudged his way in, prick trapped between Cassian's legs. Hand around Cassian's cock. Leg over all so that he had his bedmate cradled and held, and he could feel Cassian panting soundlessly. It was a remarkably motionless way to go about things, he vaguely thought. But on the other hand, he was about 3 thrusts from exploding, and when he rubbed his thumb over the tip of Cassian's prick, he could feel the viscous wetness of arousal. Small movements then. Just gentle pushes between those firm thighs, and pushing back with his fist as he did it. So he was stroking Cassian in time to his own thrusts, and Cassian was simply letting him with nothing but those stuttering, whimpering breaths to signal his desires. Tiny, pleading noises, his body in Daisel's hands, just as Daisel had wanted. Perfect.
Cassian, he whispered.
Cass, God, you're lovely. Cassian's breath caught audibly and he gave a little moan. Daisel tightened the grip of both hand and leg by instinct, holding him closer, and Cassian moaned again, in such a hopelessly wanton way that Daisel was doomed. He moved faster, no choice at all, frigging Cassian and using him to frig himself, the pair of them a mass of harsh breath and shuddering pleasure, and then Cassian gave a little cry like pain. And he was bucking in Daisel's grasp, spilling over his fist. Daisel thrust twice more between his legs and spent in a quivering, sticky, joyful mess. He slumped forward, face in Cassian's lovely shoulder. They lay together for a moment, breathing. Cassian nestled in Daisel's hold.
I'm so glad you did that,
Cassian said eventually.
Which part?
All of it, really, but did something. I didn't have the nerve.
I didn't have the nerve. I just woke up like this.
Sorry about that, he added.
Why? It was a very nice way to wake up.
Eventually, yes, but I don't suppose you wanted to find me all over you when you were fast asleep. Cassian made a noncommittal noise. Daisel brushed a very light kiss to his neck since it was within reach.
Is this, just so I know, is this something we did once, or something we might do again?
Is again a possibility? Daisel kissed his neck again, harder this time, I'd call it a likelihood. Left to myself, it would be a certainty.
Oh.
Cassian squirmed around at that, wriggling round to face him. Rain-swept eyes warm with sleep and pleasure. And Daisel kissed him. He couldn't have helped it if he tried. Cassian looked so lovely, aroused and disheveled and wanton and willing. And Daisel had wanted to kiss him for days, to find out if that expressive mouth worked as well by touch. He wanted Cassian as close as he could be, because when he was close, the world was a warm, soothing, easy place. He wanted to show his enchanting but oddly uncertain bard that he was entirely enchanted. There was a tiny moment as their lips met, a tiny stillness, long enough for Daisel to wonder if that hadn't been welcome after all, and then Cassian's arms snaked around him, gripping his head, pulling him in. His lips were hungry, and his mouth was unexpectedly fierce, and everything just for now was perfect. The day was bright and sunny, which was nice. Daisel would have been just as happy in torrential rain or a blizzard. He didn't care about weather. He cared about that slow, blissful coupling, and the long, languorous kissing that followed it. And then the second fuck, which had been a great deal more energetic than the first. Exceedingly energetic, in fact. Frantic rutting against one another, lips locked and hands on cocks, groping at hair and skin, gasping into one another's mouths so as not to be indiscreet. They'd washed and dressed and breakfasted in a post-coital glow, and then they'd set off to see the sights of Stratford-upon-Avon. It was at this point that Daisel would normally have protested. He had been obliged to watch a Shakespeare play once, for reasons he could not now remember, and it had been 3 or 4, or subjectively 18, of the longest hours of his life. If he wanted to see people shouting comprehensibly at one another, he'd go to the continent. And the thought of being in the company of someone who talked about the bard, or even worse, the Swan of Avon, chilled his blood. Luckily, Cassian showed no signs of doing that, nor did he declaim swathes of poetry that didn't rhyme. He did, however, take Daisel to Holy Trinity Church, where he'd already been to have the banns declared. Only this time he was supposed to look at it. Daisel had vaguely noticed the soaring arches and stained glass on his previous visit. Cassian wanted a great deal more detail than that. Luckily, it turned out that the ecclesiastical architecture was a deal more interesting when someone knew what he was looking at. Cassian showed him medieval tombs, and explained what the animals and symbols meant, and who the dead people were. He took him to a row of almost seats, where monks or choristers or whoever could rest their asses during Mass. And they spent a highly entertaining 20 minutes examining the peculiar and sometimes bawdy carvings underneath, and exchanging surreptitious remarks that left them both giggling like idiots. They had to see the Shakespeare family graves in front of the altar, of course, and a bust of the old fellow himself, looking like a pompous schoolteacher. Cassian contemplated it reverently and murmured something about dead shepherds, which Daisel politely ignored, but redeemed himself by pointing out some strange carved faces with leaves instead of hair, high up where Daisel would never have noticed them, and identifying them as pagan images. It was, in fact, the most interesting time he'd ever spent in a church, although the threshold for that was not high. And he said so as they strolled out through an avenue of trees. I'm glad, Cassian said. He was glowing, bright with pleasure. I do love a good church. Thank you for coming with me. Daisel's tolerance for Shakespeare's birthplace was perhaps a little less, since it was a once fine half-timbered house, now looking very mean. One half of it was an inn called the Swan and Maidenhead, for reasons he didn't want to ask. And it smelled like a brewery and a piggery at once. The half that remained a house was populated by aged dodderers who offered to show them Shakespeare's own chair, his cradle, his wife's cradle, his tragically lost son's cradle, his pipe, or whatever other tatty old rubbish they had to hand, and who were all ready to recount their great-grandfather's many stories from when he was the best of friends with the bard. This was the sort of thing a gullible man, or an excessively polite one, could be caught in for hours. Fortunately, though Cassian was exceedingly polite, he was clearly well versed in the darkest arts of courtesy,
and slid through the grasping fingers of Shakespeare hawkers like a greased pig, leaving only smiles behind. He'd had a great deal of practice in deflecting the impertinent and importunate, Dazel thought, considering he was such an unassuming young man. They also took a look at the new place, which would have been the house where Shakespeare spent his last years and died. Except that it wasn't there.
I read about this. The last owner cut down a mulberry tree planted by Shakespeare's own hands, Cassian explained. So the residents here threw stones at his windows and broke them. Then he sought the right to extend his garden, and that was refused and his taxes put up. Whereupon he felt so tired of Stratford and the Shakespeare industry that he demolished the house as an act of spite. That was just a few years ago. What a shame.
Dazel whistled.
If they broke his windows over a tree, how did destroying the house go down?
He was chased out of the town by irate locals.
Oof. Still, good for him. It was an act of appalling vandalism and an insult to history.
That said, I know what you mean, Cassian admitted.
It's all rather much here, isn't it?
I feel as if expressing a preference for the plays of Christopher Marlowe might get me strung up in the public street.
And all the relics. It's like those Catholic churches, you know, where if one put together all the fragments of John the Baptist, there would probably be enough for half a dozen complete skeletons.
Still, I suppose the town doesn't have a great deal else to recommend it to visitors.
Have you reached your limit of seeing the sights?
Not if there's anything else you want to see, Dazel said, trying to make it sound convincing.
Well, there's Anne Hathaway's cottage, which is a mile from here, but I believe it's a farm, and I don't suppose they appreciate visitors.
I'd expect they welcome visitors with open arms, as long as they sell you a clod of muck that Shakespeare trod on while he was writing Hamlet, price a mere 5 shillings.
Also possible, Cassian said.
Let's have something to eat instead. They made a light but pleasant luncheon. They strolled down to see the new canal, which offered the town a chance at Shakespeare-free prosperity that Dazel could only applaud, and walked along the River Avon, out into the surrounding countryside, to enjoy the fresh air, shoulder to shoulder. Cassian talked about interesting churches he'd seen abroad, and Dazel listened with fascination. Because he'd listen with fascination to anything in that soft enchanter's voice. They roamed and watched swans on the canal, and sat together under trees. At one point Cassian put his hand over Dazel's, just a touch, and Dazel crooked his fingers to turn the touch to a hold. They sat there like that, hand in hand, quiet and intimate. And Dazel felt peace settle over his soul. He didn't ever want this day to end. It seemed that Cassian felt an equal desire to have the most time they could, because he didn't suggest going back either. But at length, Dazel heard a church clock chime.
7, good Lord, how is it so late? We should go back.
Back to the inn and the shared bed. If time insisted on passing, at least it meant that bed. It'll be dusk soon. He stood. Above, a couple of birds cawed and flapped slowly away, black shapes against the purpling sky. Light thickens, and the crow makes wing to the rooky wood. Cassian remarked.
I beg your pardon,
Macbeth. Good things of day begin to droop and drowse, while night's black agents to their preys do rouse, he added in sinister tones.
At least it rhymes, Dazel said.
Then they set off back. They'd walked a reasonably long way out of the town, and it was well into twilight as they crossed the river. The bridge led towards a broad street with fine new buildings, more impressive than the street on which they were lodging, and the Warwick and Birmingham roads led off from around here. The area had been busy when they crossed it earlier in the day. Now, as the townsfolk retreated to their dinners and their pipes, and their minding their own business, it was quite deserted. Except for the group of 3 men who stood by the side of the road before it forked, talking. 2 were facing the bridge, and they both glanced at Dazel and Cassian. The 3rd didn't look round. They were just standing there, with their coach. Not doing anything but standing and waiting.
Cass? Keep an eye on those men. If they come towards us.
What he would like to say was, leave them to me, or something equally brave and useful. What he had was,
run for the town, don't wait for me.
What? Two of the men started walking, towards Daisel, mere shapes in the dim light. Just go, don't try to interfere. Cassian clearly wasn't a brawler, and there would probably be sticks.
What's wrong? Do you mean them? Oh, good God, you don't think it's Sir James's men?
I expect so. Daisel said grimly, pull your hat down, hide your face. We don't need them getting a look at you, and stay back now.
Sir, that was to the man approaching them. Stand off. If you have something to say, you can say it from there.
Mr. Daisel Charnage?
It wasn't really a question.
Himself, kindly state your business.
The man was large, and now Daisel saw him close up, he was familiar despite the dusk. One of Veer's men, and he was carrying a stick, more a club really, which he pointed at Daisel.
You've got in the master's way before. You won't do it again. Hand her over, and the wedding license, and then piss off out of my sight or I'll break both your legs.
At least he made himself clear.
If you mean Miss Beaumont, I don't have her to hand over, Daisel said. She left Stratford yesterday. I have no idea where she went.
You think I'm stupid?
The lout demanded.
You're going to lie to me like I'm a fool?
She's long gone, Daisel repeated. You can ask at the inn where I'm staying. I'll happily take you there. No lady.
The man shook his head, in sorrowful acknowledgement of human failings. Then he drove the butt of his stick into Daisel's stomach. He didn't see it coming fast enough. The blow knocked the air out of him to sickening effect, and he went over, down to the ground. Knowing his head and neck and back were now horribly vulnerable to blows and kicks, but unable to do anything except gasp fruitlessly for breath. There was a flurry of violent motion above him, with a cry cut off, and then a boot landed hard in his side. Daisel curled round the pain, trying to brace himself against more. It didn't come. There was more scuffling, but the sound was retreating. Daisel uncurled cautiously and saw the coach across the roadway, the driver standing waiting. Two men dragging a third oddly shaped figure with them. It took him a moment to realize the third had a blanket over his head.
Cass, he croaked.
Veer's men started bundling Cassian into the coach. He wasn't making it easy, although he was muffled in cloth. He was kicking and struggling, but there were two of them and they were big. Daisel forced himself to his feet, side and belly aching, and made himself run. It was more of a stagger with one arm round his painful side.
Hey!
He shouted. The coach door slammed. The driver cracked his whip. The coach rattled off with Cassian inside. And Daisel stood staring uselessly after it. Chapter 9. Cassian had no idea what was going on, but it was terrifying. Being confronted by large men in gathering darkness had been alarming. But he told himself Daisel would talk their way out of it. After all, they didn't have Miss Beaumont. They could prove it. He hadn't expected the sudden, frightening violence that doubled Daisel over. And he really hadn't expected what happened next. As far as he could tell, someone had thrown a blanket over his head, because he'd found himself enveloped in scratchy, close, dusty darkness, and hauled off with a brutal grip on his arm. He'd shouted and struggled. But someone had got a hard hand over his mouth, pushing the sacking against his lips. And then he'd been fighting an enemy he couldn't see, far stronger than himself, with no idea what they were doing or what had happened to Daisel. And now he was sprawling on the floor of a coach and it was moving. A hand closed on his arm, hauling him up to the seat.
Sit there and shut up,
growled the man who'd hit Daisel.
Damn nuisance. Caught me on a bloody jaw.
What are you?
Cassian began, high-pitched with fear and indignation, and was cut off by a hand grabbing at his throat.
I said shut up,
the man growled.
Little bitch. Serve you right if we treated you like your sort deserves. Keep your mouth shut now or I'll take my belt to you.
Cassian's jaw dropped under the sacking. He had never in his life been spoken to in such a way, and the urge to demand, do you know who I am? Could only be held back by the fear that the brute might find out. He didn't speak. After a couple of seconds, the hand at his throat released its grip,
dragged roughly and deliberately down over his chest, and moved off.
Little bitch, your sort.
Cassian didn't like the sound of that at all, and the fear was unfamiliar and sickening. Had he and Daisel been seen holding hands, or caught in a betraying look? He knew very well his predilections were dangerous. They got other men in bad, sometimes fatal trouble, brought them disgrace or shame even if the cruel law wasn't involved. He'd always been excruciatingly, soul-sappingly discreet himself. And yet, if the Duke were caught with a man, the consequences would all be to his self-esteem, humiliation, widespread gossip, his family's opinions. Those were bad enough. But nobody would assault him, jail him, pillory him. He was safe from all that because he was Seven. Right now, he was only Cassian, and he was terrified. He made himself breathe and think. These were Veer's henchmen, out to retrieve Miss Beaumont. If they'd taken Cassian, it was surely because they thought he could lead them to the runaway heiress. The odds were that the insults were just casual ones, aimed at his unimposing physique. He hoped to God that was the case. Why had they kidnapped him rather than Daisel, though? It made no sense. Unless, of course, someone had recognized him. That was a grim thought. If Sir James intended to accuse the Duke of Seven of abducting an underage heiress, things might well become difficult. And if everything had gone wrong and the vengeful Veer found out about the Duke and Daisel... There was no point frightening himself with possibilities. Probably he'd been taken as Daisel's companion and the easier target. And all would be resolved when he explained he had no idea where Miss Beaumont was. Until he had an opportunity to do so, he ought not to make bad worse by thinking. He was a duke even if disguised, and thus untouchable, he told himself, though the blanket over his head was rasping his skin and its dust made his throat tickle, and he was unpleasantly aware of the two large men sitting at his sides. He'd find out what was going on soon enough. In the meantime, he would not attempt to struggle against a pair of bravos in a small space. Instead, he bent his mind to considering where they might be going. He had a good innate sense of direction, and had pored over Patterson's British itinerary in his plot around the staging posts outside Stratford. Between that and the reasonable road surface, he was fairly sure they were heading up the Warwick Road. They weren't long on it, turning off to the east onto what was clearly a wretched track. The coach jolted and jerked as it rattled along, and Cassian pressed his lips together under the cover of the blanket and clenched his fists against the consuming fear. He wished Daisel were here, with that casually kind hand pressed to his knee, offering comfort unsought and unquestioning. He set his mind to that touch, and then to the other touches of their glorious morning, which now felt a very long time ago, and managed to keep his feelings of alarm to a manageable level until the coach stopped.
Right, get out. Mind those dainty feet.
Cassian found himself half lifted out. He stumbled along, pushed by unseen hands into a building. There were murmurs of speech, then sounds of appalled protest in a female voice, to which Cassian's captor growled,
"Shut your mouth. I want a back room key."
He let go of Cassian's arm as he spoke.
"But that's not..."
"I know what I'm doing, Jake, the key, I say."
Now he was on his feet, out of the coach, and in the presence of a witness, Cassian felt able to act. He pulled the horrible blanket off and blinked in what briefly seemed bright light. He was in a rather mean house. If it was an inn, it wasn't much frequented. The ceilings were low and it was lit with tallow candles. He could see his captors, and a thin-faced woman in a drab dress, and a brutish-looking man behind her. They were all gaping at him. He'd have liked to announce, "This is an outrage," but they already knew that. "What is this? Who are you people? What reason do you have for this abduction?" No answers. Everyone was still gaping. Cassian put his hands on his hips and Lord Hugo into his voice. "Well, I demand an explanation.
The second bravo swallowed.
Jim, that ain't Miss Beaumont.
I fucking know that, said the leader in a voice that promised retribution. I can see.
Well, why did you...
Now I can see.
Miss Beaumont? Cassian repeated. It had taken him a moment to regain his breath. Miss... You mistook me for a woman? Outrage warred with a wholly inappropriate desire to laugh. Great God, are you mad? They seem breeches, the woman observed in a general abstract sort of way, not skirts. The leader turned on her savagely.
They said she'd be dressed as a bloke and with that fucker charnage.
Cassian took that in with some resentment. Granted, he was on the shorter and slimmer side, and Miss Beaumont was a strapping young lady, and it had been dark, but even so. And, he now realized, that put the interaction in the coach in a new light. Serve you right if we treated you like your sort deserves. Keep your mouth shut now, or I'll take my belt to you. And the hand that had dragged, he'd thought deliberately over his chest, as padded by coat and blanket. These were the men Sir James Vere had sent after a young woman, and righteous fury exploded through him. If you cannot use your eyes, the more fool you, he said crisply. You have made a very bad mistake, and I will ensure Sir James hears of this. You will return me to Stratford right away, if you wish me to consider treating this as an error rather than a criminal act. At once! The guilty looks that shot between the second bravo and the woman made him think for a second that he'd have his way. Then the first bravo shook his head.
No.
Jim?
No, I say. He was with Charnage. Charnage took out a marriage license. He knows where she is.
I know no such thing, and nor does Mr. Charnage. Miss Beaumont left Stratford 2 days hence. You have lost her trail, and a good thing too, if this is how you treat a lady. Now get me back to Stratford. The first bravo's jaw was grinding.
We'll get Charnage. They're the White Swan. We'll go in the morning and make him tell us where she is. And we'll keep this one till then. Can't have you warn him.
Take me back immediately, Cassian said furiously. How dare you detain me like this? This is kidnapping and I will have the law on you.
Shut up,
the first bravo said, and dragged His Grace the Duke of Severn into a dirty, dark back room by the arm. He was shoved in so that he stumbled and almost fell.
Keep your gob shut,
the first bravo advised him.
Nobody round here to hear you and you'll just rile me. Be a good boy and we'll bring you something to eat and a pot to piss in.
The door banged shut behind him, leaving Cassian in the dark. He turned around, angry, astonished, and undeniably afraid. Vere's brutes were lawless to an alarming degree, and he had probably been foolish to make threats he was in no position to carry out. Once he was restored to his position, he would bring the full might of his dukedom down on Sir James, he promised himself, but in the meantime, he was locked in a room. And Daisel was probably back at the White Swan, where these bullies would arrive the next morning, determined to beat answers out of him that he wouldn't be able to give. Daisel's insistence that Miss Beaumont didn't say where she was going now seemed at once a wise precaution and a ghastly mistake. Where was he? Not in a town, it was entirely quiet out here. They turned left off the Warwick Road, and from the distance, Cassian decided they were somewhere in the depths of Warwickshire, perhaps in the region of Hampton Lucy. The irony was biting. He knew the Lucy family of Chalcot Park, which was probably within a couple of miles of here, and had even stayed in their grand Elizabethan home. If he could get out, he could seek assistance there. That would, of course, mean turning up with a dirty face and dusty hair, saying he'd been kidnapped and demanding their assistance to come to Daisel Charnage's rescue. He'd deal with that when he had to. For now, he could not simply stand here feeling outraged. He needed to think of something to do. He hadn't got anywhere on that a few minutes later when the door opened again. The first bravo entered.
The woman followed with a chamber pot and a blanket, then went out again and returned with a plate and a mug.
Food and drink,
the first bravo said.
Keep behaving and you can go tomorrow morning, no harm done.
Will you at least leave the candle? Cassian said. There are rats in here.
No such thing,
the woman said with offence.
Mice, only mice.
We can spare it, Jim.
For a fee,
the bravo said.
Board, lodging and light.